This is Floss Weekly. I'm Doc Searles. This week we have a round table that's actually rectangular. It is me, Catherine Druckmann, Sean Powers, and Jonathan Bennett together talking about security. The Open Source Security Foundation is a new and really important development in the security world around open source. We talk about subscriptions and how we're getting towards subscription overload, but it really matters. We tie that in with what's happening with podcasting and especially with newsletters. There's more and more newsletters. Is that eating away at blogging? Is blogging completely retro? We visit that. Jonathan also has a couple of cool things to show off. It's all coming up next.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Floss Weekly, episode 687. Recorded Wednesday, June 29th, 2022. Open Source Roundtable. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Collide. That's Collide with a K. Collide is an endpoint security solution built around honest security. You can meet your security goals without compromising your values. Visit collide.com/floss to learn more and activate a free 14-day trial today. No credit card required. And by Bitwarden. Get the password manager that offers a robust and cost-effective solution that can drastically increase your chances of staying safe online. Get started with a free trial of a Teams or Enterprise plan, or get started for free across all devices as an individual user at bitwarden.com/twit. Hello again, everybody, everywhere. I am Doc Searles, and this is Floss Weekly. This time, we don't have a guest other than ourselves. We are a rectangle, a round table of four people. Myself, and there she is, and Catherine Druckmann, Sean Powers, and Jonathan Bennett going left to right, and which is Salt Lake City, Houston, somewhere in Michigan, and somewhere in Oklahoma.
Tip of the pinky finger here in the, yeah, the Michigan map.
Yeah. So, yeah. Hey, guys. We actually have some stuff queued up as topics. So, Kathy, do you want to take it first? Because you're the first going left to right.
Oh, sure. Yeah, so I just dropped in. As many of you probably know, last week there was a big open source conference, the Open Source Summit, hosted by the Linux Foundation. It was in Austin, Texas, last week. And one of the days was devoted to security, the Open Source Security Foundation, that is also under the umbrella of the Linux Foundation, had a day devoted entirely to security. And one of the things they brought up was a little bit of research that they did together with another company. I cannot remember the name off the top of my head, but it found that basically a lot of companies don't have great open source security policies. People aren't necessarily handling the tremendous number of indirect dependencies that pretty much everything works on, right? And I think what I got from this is that the Log4j vulnerability that we've talked about, I know, on here before, and we all are painfully aware of probably at this point, I think it spurred some action, which is interesting, and it's worth taking a look at and reading, you know, what they came up with. But some of the interesting things that one of the articles I think I linked to suggested that a surprising number of organizations are not confident about their open source security. And I think that, you know, a lot of really brilliant minds are coming together to address that, which is part of what came out of last week. And then, you know, and then they just throw out a bunch of numbers, like the average application in development contains 49 vulnerabilities and 69 dependencies, which is just kind of a, you know, shows the how deep it can go and how much there is, that how many points of failure are, you know, potentially there when we're developing software. Anyway, there's a lot of emphasis on software supply chain security right now, and I think it's really important. And fortunately, some people smarter than me are working on it, and I'm very interested to see, you know, what these new initiatives that the Linux Foundation is getting behind, where they go from here. So anyway, that's my thing. Do y'all have any thoughts about that? I don't know about your experience dealing with these things, but I've been in the position of juggling a ton of different dependencies and trying to track down, you know, to make sure everything is up to date and secure. And the response time is an issue. That's another thing they brought up, is that the response time seems to have increased in a lot of cases, which is problematic. And I think you have
I want to get further and deeper into this, but because I forgot to go straight into the ad, I'm going to do it now and we'll get further into security. I did a human thing there. Anyway, I have to let you know, this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Collide. That's Collide with a K. IT admins often feel they have to choose between their commitment to cybersecurity and their duty to protect their employees' privacy. Naturally, you need to safeguard company data against hacks and breaches, but you don't want to turn your workplace into 1984. Traditional MDMs give the IT team complete access and control over company devices, but since employees are inevitably going to use their work laptops for personal activities, these tools can saddle you with surveillance capabilities you never wanted, like access to photos and browser history. Before you know it, your end users are complaining about all the security agents slowing down their laptops. Developers are frustrated by their lack of autonomy. People start secretly working on their personal devices just to get things done. It's easy to fall into the trap of top-down security, but it's not the only option. Collide is an endpoint security solution built around honest security. Their philosophy is that employees aren't your biggest security risk. They're your biggest allies, and your relationship with them should be based on transparency and informed consent. Collide works by notifying your employees of security issues via Slack, educating them on why they're important, and giving them step-by-step instructions on how to resolve them themselves. For IT and security teams, Collide provides the right level of visibility for Mac, Windows, and Linux devices, and it addresses high-risk issues that can't be solved through brute force or automation. What's more, your end users can see exactly why and how every piece of data is being collected via Collide's User Privacy Center and their open source code base. You can meet your security goals without compromising your values. Visit collide.com/floss to find out how. If you follow that link, they'll hook you up with a goodie bag just for activating a free trial. That's KOLIDE.com/floss. Okay, is it? We're back on the security topic here, and I just learned that Brian Behlendorf has been on the show before. He's with Hyperledger, major contributor to the original Apache code, is now working with that corner of the yes. Linux Foundation. Yep. So, was he there at the thing? We're going to have
yes,
him back on
I
the
believe
show.
He made. Yeah, he made a lot of these announcements. You should definitely have yeah. him back on the
so,
show.
Yeah, he reached out actually. Yeah, he wants to come back on the show, so wanted to bring that up. Any other thoughts on those other guys?
Yeah, I'll jump in. This is an interesting thing in open source. When you talk particularly about dependencies, there's kind of three big broad categories that this problem falls into. And so you've got, you know, on one hand, you've got like Java programs where, you know, it may all be open source, but there's a bunch of libraries that get baked into the jar file, distributed with, you know, the distribution. And so trying to fix something in one of those takes forever because you've got to do, you know, a new reversion, a new release of your program to be able to get those libraries, fixed libraries sent out. And so that's like when you look at the log4j problem, that has a long, long tail because everybody that was hit by it, they have to get a new release from their vendor that's got the new libraries built into it. And then on the other opposite extreme, you've got like the Node.js community and NPM. And those guys, I mean, they automatically, you know, depending on how they've got things set up, will automatically grab library updates on the fly every time somebody reloads the page. And that brings its own security problems because then if you have a rogue developer, or someone wanting to launch protestware, which, not to toot my own horn, but I'm pretty sure I'm the one that coined that term. Anyway, protestware, you get it if you don't have your versions pinned, or sometimes even if you do, depending upon how malicious the developer wants to be, you get potentially malware injected right in library updates. And then kind of sitting in the middle, also a big part of this conversation is like a Linux system or even a Windows system, BSD system for that matter, where a lot of those libraries are system libraries. And so the way that you update those is with your built-in package manager, or in the case of Windows, Windows Update. And it seems to me that when you talk about particularly vulnerabilities and dependencies, one of the things that makes it difficult is you've got these three totally different models that each need kind of their own approach to trying to fix some of these problems.
So another aspect of this too. Sean has things to say, maybe not intelligent things to say. So I am not a security expert, right? I mean, I think about security, but it's not my forte. And I find that often when I'm writing code, that when I think about security first, which is important, it tends to squelch my innovation, which sounds stupid, I know. But I think that it's great to have a team working on things, because somebody else is going to have a better eye or thought process for security. And, you know, I've written a lot of code that I use internally, because if it were ever exposed to the internet, everything that I do would just fall apart. You know, I mean, I have absolutely no concept, or, you know, I'm not fooling myself into thinking it's well-designed code, but it does amazing things. And so there's certainly the issue of upstream and libraries and stuff like that, but there's also even just the, you know, one developer cannot be amazing at all things. Especially if that developer lives in my body, and teams are really great for that. And so I think that a lot of times a one person show when it comes to an open source project or any project, but you know, a lot of open source projects can be a one person show. I think that there's sacrifices made there. And sometimes the sacrifices are in security. Sometimes the sacrifices are in innovation or UI. I mean, it's tough to do something well with one person. And it's kind of against the whole idea of open source, right? I mean, we want to use everybody's abilities and share and be better and live in a circle and all those things.
Yeah. I think even, Sean, you know, I kind of feel like those things in mind. Oh, sorry. Even with those things in mind, though, I mean, even, you know, the best teams from the best organizations, it's tough to even kind of have a constant mental picture of all of you know, many, many dependencies that any piece of software is running with. You know, I think that's the struggle. It's just bringing awareness, reminding people, hey, you have way more dependencies than even you quite realize. I think that's half the battle.
I also think that people like myself assume that other developers are much better than they are. And I have a really close friend of mine who's been a developer like his whole career. You know, he said, look, if it compiles and it does what it needs to do, that's the bulk of all programs. I'm like, oh, that's unsettling.
Sean, I feel like you're ahead of the curve by realizing this, these two ideas that a single programmer is probably not going to be able to write perfect code the first time. And, you know, without a team, and the other thing that you mentioned is trying to make something secure means that you don't have a whole lot of room to innovate. And this is not just a problem in open source. I covered a story where this smart hot tub, Jacuzzi and some other companies decided that they wanted to make a Internet of Things hot tub. And, you know, like we always say, the S in IoT stands for security. And essentially what they did is...
That, but that's good.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Awesome.
So what they did is they wrote a admin web page that anybody could get to. And of course, when you go to log into it, it says, hey, you're not validated to see this. But the guy that discovered this vulnerability, he realized there was also a quick flash of data before that pops up. And he got to digging into it, and all of the, you know, the checking for, are you an admin? Are you allowed to see this data? All of that authorization stuff all happened on the client side rather than the server side. It was just a totally broken model. So I kind of have this theory that if you want to write code that is both innovative and secure, you have to write it twice. And you actually see that in a lot of different projects. They'll write something really, really cool that does something really innovative, but the security model will be totally broken. And they have to go back and essentially rewrite the entire project to make it secure. And so I think that's an interesting kind of idea that you're in on there, Sean, this idea that the first time you write it, you just know it's going to be broken, and then you try to fix it later if you need to.
And maybe even if it is a one-person show, if you allow yourself to turn off those security thoughts while you're designing how you want it to work, you know, the awesome stuff, and then you turn that on in your second pass to fix the horrible code that you just wrote. I guess that is one way to go about it. But I find just personally that trying to have both of those mindsets in place at the same time just stifles everything, right? I mean, I just don't do anything because, well, I can't do that because that's a bad idea. So what's a good idea? Well, I don't know. Yeah, it's tough. So
absolutely. I don't think we mentioned it. I don't think we mentioned it. Oh. We really should. That article was from ZDNet. I don't know if it was who the author was on it, but it was a ZDNet publication. Yeah. Thanks to them for doing such, you know, over the years, really good open source coverage.
Yeah, Stephen Von. Yeah,
and thank them for not saying Von Nichols, if you're a terrible security person like Sean Powers.
Yeah.
Yeah. Don't listen to Sean, whatever you do.
But I should point out the piece by Stephen Von Nichols, and he's been on the show. So
that's true.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
If you like him, go back to our archives and listen to him. I'm wondering about the open. How old is the Open Source Security Foundation? It's. I just heard from Brian out of the blue. I mentioned him earlier, It's yet another thing under the Linux Foundation umbrella. Yeah. And those tend to include a whole bunch of companies, though I don't see companies mentioned yet, but I haven't dug into it. You guys have any insights on?
There are a few big companies definitely contributing. I want to say I've seen Red Hat and Intel and some others. I can't remember.
Likely Google and Facebook. They tend to jump in on all those things.
Yeah. But as far as how long it's been around, I actually don't know. That is
since the beginning
question.
Of its
the since director it of OWASP is on their board. That's great.
That's cool. So
the important thing is it's an important issue that needs to be addressed, and they're addressing it. So there you go.
I had this observation now that it seems like I'm now subscribing to more and more and more and more newsletters the same way I used to subscribe to more and more and more and more RSS feeds. And of course, the newsletters themselves, in some cases, do have RSS feeds as well. And most of those are Substack. So Substack has become like the alpha platform for newsletters, which must make Medium feel real happy because it resembles it in a lot of ways. And I suppose you could do newsletters on Medium as well. But again, it's on a platform rather than on your own thing, whatever that happens to be. And so there's this sort of tug of war or tug of use between fashion in publishing, ease of use, where the audience is, how you can make money, all these different things, which favors having a platform that kind of handles it all for you. But there are downsides for it too. Like I haven't seen on Substack how to get rid of the tracking cruft where they turn every link in the newsletter, not on their websites, but on the newsletter, into some long obscure URL that resolves. But in the meantime, you don't know what's happening with that. It's going to where you want it to go, but it's doing something else in the meantime that may just be analytics, but it may also be tracking you. I don't know. I actually don't know what they're doing there. You guys have any ideas about that and where this whole thing is going? There's an open source ideal underneath all of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I remember doing mailing lists with Major Domo back in the day, where, you know, that was just a mailing list. The newsletter is basically a mailing list with a purpose, I guess, is the thing. I also use Substack, but I think that's Catherine's fault. I think, you know, I said, hey,
yeah,
what
are
you using for a newsletter?
Yeah, we're using it on our own thing.
Yeah, it's certainly not ideal. I don't know. There are lots of alternatives. Yeah.
And the weird thing for me is, you know, for a long time, blogging kind of fell out of fashion, it seems like. You know, I mean, social media kind of took over the long form blogging. And then in the past couple of years, it feels like it's come back, but slightly different. Like, Doc, you mentioned Medium, right? I think that Medium has like kind of become the blogger of the current age or whatever. And I don't
I don't love that because I really like to, you know, host my own thing, have my own stuff. But I think part of it, like you said, is a monetization angle. I think you can monetize with Medium. You can monetize using Substack. All of those things allow for monetization. Whereas I don't know that that was the focus originally. Mm-hmm. Originally, it was just a place to put your stuff online. And if you wanted to make money, you had to put gaudy ads on your page all over, right? That was kind of the way. But now there's like the next generation of easy, direct from the consumer kind of payment. So I don't know if that's the reason that this platform based,
I think that's a big part of it.
Stuff is, yeah,
it's a big part of it. Part of it too is that you can easily sort of not so much syndicate it out, but you can cross publish onto. I mean, or make note, put your notifications on the social media. It'll automatically send something out to Instagram and Twitter and Facebook or whatever else you want to stick it in. And that's part of the appeal too. The WYSIWYGness of it is what looks to me so much like Medium. You know, you can't write in your own HTML editor, and you know, including the most simple kind. You have to use their editor, and that's fine if you want to do that. It certainly looks great. What you're seeing is pure WYSIWYG. What you see is what you get. But if you want to look at the HTML underneath, it is pretty darn complicated, which is what I guess.
Yeah, I mean, WordPress lets you do either. I mean, I still blog. You know, I still have a blog that I regularly write to, and I actually started reading so that I can practice for when I have an audiobook to read long form. But I'm not in love with the GUI editing interface, but it does have the option where you can go to straight up HTML if that's your jam.
Substack has
WordPress
that?
Though.
No, WordPress.
Yeah. Oh, WordPress. Yeah, I was going to say I'm used to that with WordPress. You just go back and forth between visual and text.
And it's possible to just turn WordPress into a newsletter. I mean, there's an easy, you can just send out an email of the post. And so I really think that there must be the ability to just have somebody else manage everything. That's the advantage of having a platform like Substack, or there's many others. I mean, there's tons of newsletter options out there.
Well, Review, I was about to kind of go to Review for the one that I want to start. Because the markup, which is run by Julia Angwin, who's a real big privacy researcher, used to be with the Wall Street Journal and other places, and they went with Review a couple of years ago for their newsletter because Review had the option to do no tracking whatsoever, and it was right up front. That's now part of Twitter. So Twitter bought them, and it's part of some other Twitter platform. And that's a risk with some of these things. They get bought by somebody. Yeah. You know, and then all of a sudden it's all different. So sort of the risk of, you know,
and then putting your trust in some.
That's why some of us are such self-hosting fans. But I also struggle trying to figure out what goes where. You know, I've settled on, and I haven't made it perfectly successful yet. But I think that it's a gray line between what is a blog post and what is a newsletter. And for me personally, like, a newsletter is a great way to compile best of from different areas. Like, you know, for example, I do YouTube videos and I do silly things on Twitter and I blog and I make Kool-Aid and post TikToks of it. And I think for me, a newsletter has to be like, nobody has all the time or insanity enough to do follow everything I do. So here's some of the things that are most weird, you know, and send out a newsletter. It's almost like a summary of the past month or however often it is. And that's the best I can do is for myself is to differentiate what a blog versus a newsletter is. And Ant has something. I'd love to hear what he has to say. He wants to chime in.
Yeah, I think with newsletters, they're basically something that you send out to highlight what has happened with the products that you're creating, whether it's blogs, whether it's videos, things like that. So, hey, this is my newsletter for this week to let you know that I posted 3 times about this or I posted twice about that, yada, yada, yada. Here they all are, just in case you didn't see them when I published them live, if you will. That's my 2 cents.
I think that's how I always thought of it, you know, but I think recently Substack in particular that Doc mentioned has this sense of, and they position themselves that way. They have it as a long form writing platform. They even, you know, they have, you know, writing mentorship programs they did at one point, I remember. But it's not geared toward, let's say, a marketing email. It really is geared toward people writing blog posts in that format. And it does, it even, you know, in the email archive is laid out very much like a kind of a simple blog, which is interesting. It's I understand the initial question, which is blogging sort of becoming, you know, morphing into newsletter writing.
And I think, for example, like
platforms position themselves.
Yeah. Like Medium and now Substack in this regard. For example, Phil Plait, the Bad Astronomer, you know, great, awesome guy. He has a Substack newsletter, and some of it is subscription-based. Substack allows like subscriber-only newsletters, which, again, a monetization angle that would be difficult to do, I think, on your own. You know, I mean, if you were just like on your blog and you sent out emails, it would be tough to do. But I think that's the service they're providing. And I mean, a service for blogging, I guess, is something that most people need, but I mean, we're a fairly nerdy group here, so, you know, spinning up a blog somewhere isn't as much of a challenge. But
speaking as a reader, I really hate the freemium tees. Matt Taibbi does it. There's some other guys that do it. You're reading three or four paragraphs. No, only for subscribers here. You know what? I subscribed to a whole bunch of newsletters already. You know, let me get a little bit farther. I'll pay you when I'm ready. You know, I don't like it. But this is a personal preference. Obviously, it works for him and others like that. The concern I have is that Substack may turn into something of a verb. Like, I'm not the way Tweet did. You know, I'm tweeting this. You know, I'm going to Substack this. You know, that
where is that it a becomes. Thing? I've never heard that.
It is now
it's just, it's Doc's fault.
You feared it here first. That's sort of
hey, so I've got to jump in with this concept of the newsletter as the platform. That, so again, this is kind of my background at Hackaday speaking. What we do over there is we find, you know, the best stuff around the net and bring it to people. If your content is only in a newsletter, you've got this real problem about discoverability, but also archival, right? If it only exists in the email that's being sent out, then there's no place, you know, 10 years from now, somebody can Google and find your content. And then we just had a conversation about this over at Hackaday. There's another problem that we're seeing, and that is where people are trying to monetize, they've kind of figured out that the juice for getting all the views is much different than the juice for here's step by step how to do the same thing that I did. And so we're seeing a lot of these, you know, really, some of them really creative hacks, really creative projects, but it's like there's not enough details about what's been going on. It's just the sizzle reel. And it's kind of this kind of hidden downside of the way monetization right now works. So there's some of these things that I think as the internet community of hackers and open source evangelists and enthusiasts, we're kind of trying to figure out still, how is this going to work? That's going to work for everybody. It's kind of an open question.
So Substack actually does. I mean, so the way that the archive is presented, you wouldn't have to ever subscribe to a newsletter to see it. It is very Googleable, discoverable. It's laid out just like it might as well be a blog, which of course the obvious question there is, well, then why not just make a blog and have those, you know, have their blog posts sent out by email. So that's, you know, I think the original question, it's kind of a weird chicken and egg thing right now. I think it's like, is it a blog? Is it a newsletter? I don't know.
Yeah. There's a real question about whether blogging is retro or passe or kick to the side. And I want to visit that and other questions. This is a good thread, but first I have to pause and let you know that this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Bitwarden. Bitwarden is the only open source cross-platform password manager that can be used at home, at work, or on the go, and is trusted by millions. With Bitwarden, you can securely store credentials across personal and business worlds. Every Bitwarden account begins with the creation of a personal vault. Bitwarden has big news. After launching the username generator last month, they're integrating with three popular email forwarding services that also happen to be open source. Those are Simple Login, AndyAndy, and Firefox Relay. Now, adding another layer of security and privacy is easier than ever when using Bitwarden to generate a new username. The option to create an email alias is presented with a sub-selection for choosing your preferred service. Just enter the API key for your individual account with the chosen service, select the desired options, and once generated, a new alias is instantly registered to your account. Using unique usernames, email addresses, and passwords for every account is a powerful method for increasing internet security and privacy and adds protection to logins in the face of data breaches and leaks. This feature will be available on the Web Vault desktop app and browser extensions with mobile planned for a future release coming soon. Bitwarden is a must-need for your business. It's fully customizable and adapts to your business needs. Use Bitwarden Send, a fully encrypted method to transmit sensitive information, whether text or files, generate unique and secure passwords for every site with enterprise-grade security. That's GDPR, CCPA, HIPAA, and SOC 2 compliant. Their end-to-end encrypted vault helps mitigate phishing attacks. Their team's organization option is $3 a month per user. Share private data securely with coworkers across departments or the entire company. Enterprises can use Bitwarden's enterprise organization plan for just $5 per month per user. Individuals can use their basic free account forever for an unlimited number of passwords or upgrade anytime to their premium account for less than $1 a month. Their family organization plan gives up to 6 users premium features for only $3.33 a month. Here at Twit, we are fans of password managers. Bitwarden is the only open source cross-platform password manager that can be used at home, on the go, or at work, and is trusted by millions of individuals, teams, and organizations worldwide. Get started with a free trial of a Teams or enterprise plan, or get started for free across all devices as an individual user at bitwarden.com/twit. That's bitwarden.com/twit. Okay, so back to the question at hand, which is blogging fully passé, or is it a permanent feature? I hope to think it's a permanent thing. It's just, we're always going to do that.
I think it's just writing, right? I mean, yeah. I don't think writing is going away anytime soon. I think it's being augmented by things like video and podcasts and stuff. But I think, blogging as a term is just like how we present it. So yeah, maybe as a, I don't know, it seems like an older term. But I think that this conversation really points to another issue that is kind of difficult with any open source project, and that's monetization, right? I think all of these weird little quirky new things that are happening are around monetization. If you want to live indoors and, you know, write for a living, and you're not part of a big corporation, which, I mean, let's be honest, a lot of the big content producing places are closed down now. It's difficult. It's a weird place in creator timeline world, whatever, to figure out how to monetize. Yeah. See, I'm so eloquent. This is why I do a lot of post editing. It's a tough place to be, you know, because things like YouTube, you know, they do monetization with ads, you know, so that's pretty clear, but it's not so clear with writing. You know, I think Ant mentioned in the back channel that he has like a supporting thing on his blog where, like, you know, people can click to support him. And I have that on like my comic page. Those aren't a consistent revenue stream though. And to come up with a consistent revenue stream that you can pay your bills with, that's a tough place to be, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just a really tough place. Yeah, buy me a beer there. And it's weird because I put a beer in a box and shipped it and it spilled and he just got this cardboard.
I like the buy me a beer. That's perfect. That's great.
Monetization is an issue. And with open source projects and now with this too.
Well, this is...
I mean, Patreon.
Back in early Linux Journal days, we made this interesting distinction, which is, do you make money with something or do you make money because of it? You make money because of open source. You don't make money with open source so much, right? So the monetization is a secondary or side effect of it. Now, what the sort of freemium, we're going to give you four paragraphs and then charge you unless you, if you don't, to make you subscribe, is an approach there. That is a way to monetize it. If the whole point is to monetize in the first place, you go there. But there's a, it's an interesting question. I mean, let's look at podcasts for a second, because Facebook has just killed off their podcasting thing that they were doing with, and Bloomberg decided that they were going to not podcast anymore on the Facebook platform. There's news about this, and I had no idea that that there was any podcasting on Facebook at all. And it turned out it was all part of a sort of monetization thing. It started out with how do you make money, and here's another publishing platform, really, that they charge for. I think, I'm really not sure what they were doing there, except that you just know that, yeah, there you go. Yeah, Bloomberg wrote, Facebook pulls the plug on podcast business after a year. What was that business? And an interesting thing is, if you dig into it, it's a meta service at a Facebook site, which tells you how much Meta is actually a division of Facebook more than Facebook is a division of Meta. I think Google pulled off the create your own parent move with Alphabet better than Facebook did with Meta. But the interesting thing there is podcasting is inherently, it's kind of an open sourcey thing. It's a way of doing something for free. It really was just a file that you put in a feed, right? You have an RSS feed with a file in it. It's an audio file. That's all it was. It was super, super, super simple. And now it's turned into an industry, right? With, Joe Rogan getting $100 million and The Ringer getting $200 million, and Stitcher getting $325 million from SiriusXM. And I don't know whether that's going to pay off yet or not, but the assumption there is that podcasting is the new talk radio. So we might as well move into that business as soon as we can. You guys have any thoughts about that? What's happened in the, is podcasting?
Yeah, I only make for that? Half of what Joe Rogan does on my podcast, and it's still nothing.
You're talking just five figures, man. Six, not seven figures, right?
It's tough. The whole content creation, it's difficult to do as a main thing that you do, right? I mean, when it becomes more than a hobby, it's tough. You said open source. I don't remember your exact terminology there, Doc, which was, as usual, really good.
You make money with
that I clearly don't have.
Yeah, money because of it, not with it.
And that's great philosophically, but also it's really nice to pay for things.
Nice to get paid for things. Yeah.
So there's this model that's kind of gaining traction in a lot of different places. And the one that I, most clearly found is over at Asahi Linux. There's a page there about support. And they say they have two different things. And they say, hey, support us on Patreon or support us at GitHub Sponsors, which if you go to GitHub Sponsors, it is essentially a Patreon model. And that's the idea of individuals, the little guys out there that really appreciate what you're doing, can chip in 5 or 10 or 15 or 20 bucks a month. And, if only one person does that, yeah, you're talking about buy me a beer range. But if you get 1,000 people doing that, well, suddenly you're getting closer to what you can live on. And it's interesting that so many services are kind of embracing this. So Patreon was one of the first that started it. GitHub's on board. Over on YouTube, you can become a member of a channel if they've got it set up. And that's the exact same thing. Twitch, exact same thing. You could be a subscriber. That's what, $5 a month, I think. This is one of the models that's really coming out as being a win. And it does a couple of neat things for us, I think. I like it. I like the subscriber model personally, because first off, it gets us away from ad-based advertising, ad-based monetization. That's always been just a little odd. Especially for individuals, like trying to make money using ads on YouTube, let's say. It's always been a little weird and a little iffy. It gets creators closer to their fans. One of the neat things that happens with a lot of these is, you sign up for Patreon and you get put into a private Discord where you can talk directly with the creator. I mean, that's what we have on Club Twit, Twit Plus. So it's a neat model. And I'm wondering if that's not going to be the model that's really going to take over. We see software projects doing it. I know people that are making YouTube videos are doing the same thing. A lot of YouTubers that I follow are doing the same thing. And I'm sure that people doing kind of the long form blog stuff are fiddling around and working on that kind of same thing. And you could do it. There's no reason you couldn't do it with Patreon. In fact, I think Patreon has tools to be able to create blog posts that are only available to your supporters. So I find that a really interesting and kind of compelling new way to do monetization.
I do like the aspect of choice too. And it's very convenient that Club Twit does this for us in that you can subscribe for money and then for a certain amount and then not see ads. The same thing with YouTube Premium, right? I mean, YouTube Premium is by far my favorite subscription service that I currently have. I would cancel Netflix before I canceled YouTube Premium because never seeing ads in YouTube videos makes my YouTube experience far better than I imagined it would be. I thought it would it would make things slightly nicer. Oh my goodness, is it amazing to have YouTube Premium. I feel like this is sponsored by YouTube Premium or whatever, but it's amazing. And I like that there's a choice because like when I look at my ad revenue from YouTube, which is very minuscule, right? I'm the total time I've had a monetized channel, I've made like $100. But when I look at the percentage, the vast majority of income still comes from ad revenue. And I like that people have that choice, right? I mean, if you can't afford a subscription or that's something that you don't want to do, you can still just see ads and enjoy it. But what the premium you're paying for is not whether or not you see the content, but how you're supporting that content. I really like that model. And I have a rant about something that is inappropriate probably for a live stream. So I won't talk about it.
So we'll save that for the Club Twit exclusives.
Yeah, we'll get to those in a few minutes. I think I thought like 2 years ago we were moving toward peak subscription. I totally agree with Jonathan. It's a wonderful model. It's just that everybody thinks it's a wonderful model, and then we move to the all subscription thing. I mean, television is there. We're staying in a hotel, and I look at the guide on TV, and it's all garbage. I mean, and it's just free. Right. And the stuff that costs money is good. It's prestige TV, premium TV, you know, Hulu, Disney and Netflix and Amazon and all the rest of them. And we always thought we'll do one or two of them. We're doing all of them now. We're doing all of them. And it's crazy. And on top of that, when I was kind of researching this, the newsletter thing, I found out, well, geez, I have like 30 Substack subscriptions. And a bunch of them are paid. I'm paying for these. And I forgot. I like to challenge the audience or challenge anybody to come up with an open source tool for managing all your subscriptions that anybody can riff off of.
We get really ads for one that'll do it. I don't know what it's called.
Just a way to like, you know, when do they start? When do they stop? Is there an API that somewhere that somebody could do? Like, what are the deals that are coming up? How do you flag when these things need to be canceled? You only want Hulu for a month, or you start with Peacock and you get it for 99 cents for a month and then it's some other number after that. I'm making that up, but I have no idea what Peacock costs.
Sirius XM. Doc. He said it was a thing.
Yeah. I mean, but there are other things too, like Sirius XM. You've got to call these people up. You can't just like go with
Sirius XM. All the That's automatic. A whole other rant.
Yeah. All of them. But Sirius XM is they don't need the satellites anymore. They just have. You know, a service, but that's a whole, you're right. That is another rant. I've got that one too. But we need some way to control this stuff. This ought to be a doable thing, right? But I don't, and there's Truebill and a couple of others, but they don't
have
like
the one that
terms.
I see. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think we need some sort of base code for how to do this. So there we go. Which charge be?
Oh, did Ant find one for us?
Thanks. That's
so what
awesome.
Is that? Let's find it.
Let's
already. Our research department, Ed Pruitt, has found something.
He just made that website up. It's full of ads when you go
to the show. We'll find out. I mean, you know, I mean, there is another principle that says it's probably been invented, whatever it is you think you want, you know? So you gotta, how many billions?
And if you've thought of it and nobody else has invented it, well, that's a business opportunity there.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So that's a little bit of a challenge.
The first step is always to buy a domain name that you'll never end up using.
I know.
That hurts.
I feel personally attacked.
Uh-huh.
I had bullforge.com and halfacat.com for the longest time.
I still have penguinjournal.com, and that has never come to fruition. So.
Oh, wow.
I still have iheartdrupal.com. It just redirects to my personal site, though.
Oh, that's good. Nice little plug there. So in Appchica. So what's this that we're seeing now that ChargeBee? So we have a little echo going on out here for ChargeBee. It's ChargeBee.
That's a platform for businesses who want to manage subscribers, right? Or is it
a way for us to manage our services?
Well, what we need to do is reach out to them and see if we can schedule an interview with them and get the
we need guests. We need guests. We'll troll for guests.
And they'll come on for the first 10 minutes of the podcast, and then they'll charge us if we want to have them talk for more than the first 10 minutes.
That's an interesting thought. A podcast guest subscription service. That's actually a much better system than the PR one, where you just get lots of spam out of the blue for people you never heard of, where we get other parties. Oh, my God. Oh yeah, we get a lot of it, yeah. And you know, because their email is out there, you know, and people send us stuff that has nothing to do with open source or whatever. To the credit of the smart PR people out there, we do get some good ones. So I don't want to knock them entirely, but that is an interesting, weird thought, isn't it? That you you have one kind of master, really smart PR person out there that does nothing but recognize that many podcasts need guests. And just charge her. I'll find them for you. There's like a finder's fee for getting appropriate guests for your podcast.
Organizations.
Hey, Doc, what is a subscription service that you think is awesome? Or no, how about Jonathan? What do you think is a great subscription service?
Well, it's interesting you ask, because here at TWIT, we do have Club TWIT. And the main thing with Club TWIT is you get ad-free versions of all the shows, but personally, I don't think that is the biggest draw. I think the biggest draw for Club TWIT is the TWIT Plus feed, which is where you get to see your favorite hosts and guests goofing off or sometimes making good points after the show. These are the things that don't make it into the mainline shows. You get the TWIT Plus feed. But the other thing that you get, well, you get access to the Discord, of course, but you get a couple of shows that only exist for Club TWIT members. And of course, there's GizFizz, but the one that I think is just the best is the Untitled Linux Show, hosted by yours truly. And I just have to say, everybody out there listening to Floss, you would love ULS, the Untitled Linux Show. So go make sure, get on Club TWIT and subscribe to it. Go grab our feed. We're looking to pump our numbers up. But we have a great time. It goes live every Saturday. So sign up to Club TWIT. It's just $7 a month. Head over to twit.tv/clubtwit and join today. We thank you for your support.
There will probably be a rant from Sean Powers on an upcoming thing. I'm waiting.
It makes me want to go sign up.
Do we have a couple of minutes? I can show off a couple of devices. I have these. I have them ready. And I think they'll be interesting for folks.
Yeah.
Totally. All right. So I've got two different things here. This one is not mine, but it is the Valve Steam Deck, which ships with Linux on it, Arch Linux. It's customized a bit by Valve. Neat little device. I'm not going to do a full review. We don't have time for that. Other people on Twitter have done it. Cool idea, though. And then the other thing that just came in is the HP Dev 1, HP's laptop that shipped with, of all things, Pop OS on it. And the thing that I love about the Dev 1, so normally when you buy an OEM laptop, particularly when it comes with Windows and you want to keep Windows, it comes with so much bloatware on it. You know, HP's this service and that service, or you get it from Dell and Dell Support Assist and all of these different things. That HP laptop is just Pop OS. It is, from what I can tell, it is a vanilla install of Pop OS with like, I believe it asked for a terms of service agreement, which may also exist in Pop OS, and had one shortcut on the desktop, and that was it. And it was just a shortcut to a web page. Beautiful experience as far as the Linux experience goes. But I find it real interesting that we have these two devices, very well done devices, kind of high profile devices, shipping with good Linux on them. Now, there's some warts with the Steam Deck, of course, but that has a lot to do with the, you kind of have two layers of translation going on there, because you got to run everything in Wine, and then you also have to run these games designed for mouse and keyboard on a, you know, on a tablet. But I find it real fascinating that, you know, here in the last couple of months, we've seen these two, like I said, really good devices shipping Linux. And I don't know, I don't want to go off on the whole year of the Linux desktop thing, but it seems like we're maybe getting a little more mainstream. What do you guys think?
A decent price too. I mean, that just on the screen there. I mean, wow. I have Dell does the Ubuntu developer. They have a name for it. I don't remember the name. And I have one of those, and it's a shockingly good Linux experience out of the box as well. Mm-hmm. Are they all AMD? Is that the?
Yes. The Dev one, it's $1,100. It comes with the Ryzen 7 Pro, the 5850U, and 16 gigs of RAM and a 1 terabyte SSD. Really pretty decent specs. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, especially the SSD, that's a big SSD for that much money. It's cool. I think, you know, half the phones on the planet or more are now Linux. So maybe the year the desktop happened, it's just
two years
Linux in the pocket. I don't know what we call that. Yeah.
Interesting to me that they're really marketing it as the developer's laptop, which is very interesting. Mm-hmm. I think, I think I increasingly see developers using Linux laptops more than, I mean, we all know how many developers are actually just using Macs, right? I mean, we know that.
Yeah.
But I think I see more and more Linux laptops, which is interesting. Or I did back when I left my house in the before time. And I personally know of people I communicate with on, you know, through via the wonderful internet that are using Linux laptops. So interesting.
We may soon enter the, instead of the year of the Linux laptop, the millennium of the Linux laptop when it finally happens.
There's, I thought, no, Chromebooks, the genie, were gonna do it.
The genie will not go back in the bottle. It'll be over, and then, you know. But we're,
I mean, Chromebooks,
waiting.
I think it becomes less and less relevant.
Chromebooks are all over the place. They're in schools everywhere.
I think they're still the perfect idea for an educational environment, because it doesn't tie a person or an account to a device. You know, they're just a way to get to an account. So, I mean, that's for education, especially like high school, middle school, elementary. That's a nice feature where if they drop it, they can get another one and all their stuff is right there. So.
I set an elderly lady up the other day, one of my customers, with a, not a Chromebook, but a Chromebox to replace an old Windows 7 desktop. And so far that's worked out pretty well. So more than just education. I have to worry, though, that Chrome OS will kind of leave a bad taste in people's mouth because they remember it from their bad old school days.
It could be.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. If your school experience is awful, this may, you know, yeah, exactly.
Especially because a lot of them are on such horrible hardware, right? That the experience wasn't even because of Chrome OS. It was because it was, you know, a Celeron from 1997 or something, basically in the, But yeah, this episode is brought to you by Sharkleberry Finn. Do you wonder what the 90s smelled like? Sorry.
That's great. That's actually a drink. It looks like a votive candle somehow. It's a
it's not hot enough to nerd a glass full of wax here. What's that?
So we're getting down toward the end of the hour. Yeah. Any turns we've left unstoned here that we should be visiting?
Sharkleberry Finn. We got so we're good, I think. We got everything.
We've gone from security to Sharkleberry Finn. I don't know if we have left any stones unturned.
I have not looked at the back channel at all. Is that in keeping up with us in any way?
I have Catherine no just idea. Titled the episode "From Security to Sharkleberry Finn," episode 687.
Somebody wants the Linux game machine next time. Yeah. Okay. I had to check too quickly.
I want to, I'm kind of curious about Chrome OS on an i7. Like, where does that happen? Is there like a really high end there? Do you have to do that?
Remember yourself? The Pixelbook, the original Pixelbook? It was like so expensive.
No, I don't.
And they did it was a weird aspect. It was like a 3:2 aspect ratio on the screen, and it was like aluminum. It was like, it was weird. The original Google Pixelbook, I think, is what it was called. Maybe I'm wrong, but it was really expensive, and it was just a Chromebook. It was so bizarre.
I don't really remember that.
And since they figured out how to make things, I guess, more or less, or good enough. It's fairly, what do they cost now? What does a Chromebook cost?
Depends on how nice it is.
Yeah. The box I picked up was like $269 on Amazon, but you could spend, you can spend $1,000 on one if you want real high-end hardware.
Oh, yeah.
I see, yeah.
That's a normal aspect ratio now. The first one was weird.
Yeah.
Interesting. And so, is quick with those screenshots. He's like the lawnmower man back there.
Really?
Yeah, if you're not watching the video feed, if you're only listening to the audio, you really miss out.
Yeah.
True. This is a go back and watch the video one, I think we have here. And so what do we, of course, this is a show where we reviewed everything all the way through the show. So maybe it's more or less at the time for the plugs, I would guess.
Plugs.
So we could just go left to right. For those of you who are not visually impaired,
just
Catherine.
Oh, wow. What do I have to plug? I don't. We do that other podcast. If you'd like to hear from me and from Doc more, and also Sean quite frequently, I guess we need to have Jonathan on next. Sure. Yeah, check us out at reality2cast.com. We talk a lot about tech policy and privacy and those kinds of things. It's not limited to open source, but we get around. Also, use Drupal and keep it updated. Do those security patches. Don't let time pass. Sorry, bringing it full circle here.
Yeah, we go out of our way not to be duplicative or overlapping too much with this show. So, except for the personalities involved. So, Sean, great cartoon, by the way.
And you know what? I haven't drawn it because I had COVID for like a month. Well, 22 days of infectiousness. I was sick for a long time with COVID. I haven't done my comic in a long time.
That wasn't funny.
Yeah, oh, good. So that website, SeanPowers.com, with the zero and the O for Sean Powers, it links to all my stuff. If you want to read my blog or you want to hear me read my blog, it's also a podcast. And yeah. Yeah. SeanPowers.com.
You're selling it so hard.
I mean, it's just me, right? I feel like when you... There it is.
He is a man of many places. And Jonathan, your different camera actually doesn't look bad.
No, it's not terrible. It's the old camera I used to use before I invested in the DSLR, which is for whatever reason broken today. Anyway, you can of course catch me over at the Untitled Linux Show, but also at Hackaday.com. Right there, at the very least, the security article goes live every Friday morning, covers the interesting stuff and the things you need to know about that happened during the week. Quite often we get somebody in the comments will say, I hadn't heard about this. I'm vulnerable. You save my bacon. So if you're a sysadmin at all, you probably should be over there checking that out.
It's always me. I'm always that person.
It's always Sean. Okay, well, we need somebody else along with Sean.
Yeah, and I am actually prepared this time to tell you that I can tell you our guest next week is Matthew Hodgson of matrix.org, and Jonathan is going to be the co-host again on that one. So that is coming up next week. It promises to be a good one. I didn't have to stumble my way into that. So thank you, everybody. This has been a good one. We'll see you next week with Matthew Hodgson coming on. And until then, enjoy. See you next week.
Did you spend a lot of money on your brand new smartphone and then you look at the pictures on Facebook and Instagram and you're like, what in the world happened to that photo? Yes. You have. I know. It happens to all of us. Well, you need to check out my show, Hands-On Photography, where I'm going to walk you through simple tips and tricks that are going to help make you get the most out of your smartphone camera or your DSLR or mirrorless, whatever you have. And those shots are going to look so much better. I promise you. So make sure you're tuning in to twit.tv/hop for Hands-On Photography to find out more.